Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to the Addiction Professional Panel Series. My name is Jennifer Turney, and I'm the Vice President for Custom Content for Addiction Professional. Thank you all for joining us this morning. This is a great crowd, and we're in for a really fantastic panel discussion. Today's topic is self-care for therapists, strategies, techniques, and ethics. And we have an impressive panel of experts ready to weigh in. But before we do that, we have a few housekeeping notes. Today's program is eligible for one continuing education credit. You should have received a certificate of participation as you came in. If not, be sure to check with the registration desk on your way out, and we'll get that set up for you. Please be sure to complete the evaluation at your place setting. This evaluation allows us to continue to offer CE credit at our programs. For those of you who registered in advance, you should have also received your American Express gift card. So if you did not receive that, please check in with registration and we'll make sure that that gets to you. In deference to our sponsors today, please refrain from passing out any promotional materials. And for those of you who tweet, does anyone tweet out there? Okay, our hashtag for today's event is AP Series. So don't hesitate to continue that conversation online. Today's event is made possible by four sponsors who are outstanding supporters of the recovery community. Dominion Diagnostics is our 2016 Panel Series Thought Leadership Partner, and Foundations Recovery Network is our 2016 Panel Series Sponsor. Both of these organizations are supporting this program in cities across the country. Today's program is also sponsored by Mount Regis Center and Marrow Lake Recovery Center. Also, our promotional partner is IC&RC. We'd like to thank them all for their participation. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. We have four very credentialed, experienced panelists today, and I'm just going to read a few comments about them. I couldn't possibly read their entire bios because we want to hear what they have to say. But Mark Albritton joins us today courtesy of Dominion Diagnostics. He is the quality director at the ranch. He has 17 years of experience in the mental health field. His work as a mental health provider has ranged from direct client contact, liaison between regulatory agencies, and facility administration. He has owned and operated a small business in Dixon County, and his experience has taught him the importance of confidentiality. He also understands the importance of meeting both the needs of regulatory agencies and accomplishing quality care. Trey Bullitt from Dominion Diagnostics, would you like to say a few words? Thank you, Trey. Chris Blunt is the Senior Psychological Examiner with Mirror Lake Recovery. She is a licensed Senior Psychological Examiner in Tennessee and a licensed Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselor, in addition to having 3-year certification in Mental Health First Aid USA. Chris recently completed a Centers of Excellence certification in Addiction and Recovery, sponsored by National Council for Behavioral Health. Michelle Parks, would you like to say a few words about?
Engaging with their peers, with their counselors, and we have we've really seen a reduction in our AMA rate with that population. We also have a non-opiate detox that is available for our clients. It utilizes Neurontin, Vistral, and Xanaclex. And that's really for clients that maybe have had multiple treatment episodes in the past 6 months. We have a Christian program called Renew that is, the supervisor for that program is a master's level therapist and also a pastor. So that is for someone that is merely a choice, for someone that wants to incorporate their biblical beliefs into treatment. We are in network with most of the major insurance companies, so we can utilize the client's benefits for treatment. We work with them on any out-of-pocket costs, and we provide mobile assessments. Rebecca is our mobile assessor. She will go out, meet with the client, do a face-to-face evaluation, determine if they're appropriate for treatment, verify benefits, schedule the bed, schedule transportation. She will take the workload off of you and also engage the client in treatment sooner. Justin Adams is our CEO, and Kristen Wolf is our director of marketing. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Michelle. Mary Moran currently serves as the Director of Outpatient Services at Foundations Recovery Network. Mary has over 25 years of experience creating and leading clinical teams. She also has served as the director for several federal grants related to the research and implementation of evidence-based practices for treating individuals with addiction and mental health issues. She is committed to providing treatment that improves the lives of individuals experiencing addiction and mental health issues. Patrick Fasci, would you like to say a few words about Foundations?
So I'm Patrick Fasci with Foundations Recovery Network. What we are is a network of treatment facilities. We specialize in evidence-based integrated dual diagnosis treatment for co-occurring disorders. Good, I got that out this time. It's hard to get that piece down. So we got five residential facilities, and we're about to have 10 intensive outpatient facilities kind of spread out throughout the U.S. here. Our corporate headquarters is located in Brentwood. That's also where our call center is at as well. If you have any questions about Foundations on anything, feel free to reach out to me. I'm sitting right here. Find me later. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Patrick. Lisa Hatcher is the Business Development Director at Mount Regis Center in Salem, Virginia. Lisa promotes not only having high standards of service delivery, but she also really actively promotes self-care and personal development as a means to continuously improving quality by her staff and colleagues. She is a certified professional life coach and a member of the American College of Healthcare Executives. Lisa, will you tell us a little bit about Mount Regis?
Yes, Mount Regis Center is an inpatient medical detox residential partial hospitalization and IOP program in Salem, Virginia. So it's a little bit of a drive, but we've been in business for a very long time. We've been providing service in a building that was built in the 1800s for over 69 years. And we are getting ready to move into a brand new facility, doubling our size, 48 beds. And so we're expanding our network, getting ready to make that jump into a brand new state-of-the-art facility. We have specialty programs for young adults, relapse prevention, trauma and abuse, and co-occurring disorders.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
So now just to jump right in, and I'm going to start with you, Chris.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you think are the main sources of fatigue or burnout among therapists?
I think for a lot of clinicians, one of the main things that we struggle with is feeling like it never stops. Whether you're a beginning clinician or a seasoned clinician, you can easily take on the client's needs to where you feel like it's 24/7, whether it's the client showing up at your door wanting to speak to you, the insurance company needing to do a UR visit, you go home and someone from the facility, you know, calls you to give you a report of what's happening. It's real easy to just feel like it goes on and on and on, and difficult setting some boundaries.
And Mark, have you also found the loss of boundaries to be a result of or?
Well, as the quality manager, I told these folks what I did, you know, because what I do for a living is I do audits and I do surveys and all that good junk. So I sent these questions out to 100 different therapists that work for us, and I got them to give me feedback and brought their feedback. Most of them put on there, it's the amount of clients that I have to deal with. It's the long hours. It's the caseload. Reduce my caseload and I'll be a happy camper kind of thing. I don't really believe that. I believe that the greatest source of the fatigue and the burnout is in how they take care of themselves, the whole core of what we're talking about today, self-care. If you learn how to take care of yourself personally, you can have a large caseload. You can have a lot to do because you can still function to learn that balance. So in my opinion, that the greatest source of burnout and fatigue is lack of ability to take care of yourself. That's just how I think it.
And Lisa, have you found that as well?
Actually, yes, I've found that with people that I work with and also with myself. And my first introduction to explain how that happens, how we fall into that trap, was early in my career. And I was moving up the ladder pretty rapidly. And I was meeting with the chief operating officer about a job that was open that would be another promotion. And I said to him, you know, I know that I could do the job, but this the last one that I did, the project was so big, I put my heart and soul in it, and I just don't think I can do it right now. And he laid down what he had in his hand, and he looked at me directly, and he pointed at my face and said, and that's what you need to learn. And I was still around 30, and I said, what do you mean? And he said, your heart does not belong to a company, and your soul only belongs to you and your God. And so I was like, what? He doesn't want me to be devoted to the company? Well, it took me many years to understand what he was saying. He was trying to say, take care of yourself first.
And so, Mary, I'll direct this question to you. What are the danger signs that clinicians should look for in themselves and in others?
As we're talking about what they are all talking about, in general, I think the danger signs that clinicians are not good at recognizing is before they get overwhelmed, before they're feeling out of control, before they're feeling like their heart and soul is into it, learning how to back off and be able to recognize that sooner, I think, is a huge thing. I work with a woman, and you're going to know who I'm talking about. This is, for me personally, as a supervisor, I've done this for a really long time. She always goes back to her office to sit and kind of collect herself before she starts a session. And my first reaction as doing this for a really long time is, oh gosh, she kind of is going to need to get over that. And the more I thought about it, I think that's incredibly good self-care. I had to kind of check myself at the door going, okay, where is this coming from? But I think not losing that wide open mind at the beginning that people walk into, putting themselves with their client when they're there, but also when they're not, to back off from that and practicing really good self-care, learning how to recognize that in yourself, I think is incredibly important.
Another example I was taught several years ago was it's kind of at the end of the day, because as clinicians, as things are coming at you, you have to learn to prioritize your tasks so that you don't become overwhelmed. And an example that a fellow used was at the end of the day, he would pick up his hat, he'd pick up his paperwork, go sit it down on his desk. He stored that away. That's done for the day. He would pick up his hat, whether it's a real hat or an imaginary hat, put it on and walk out the door to symbolize I'm leaving this here, I'm setting that boundary, and I'm stepping onto the next area, and I'm going to give my full attention there.
And so we talked a little bit, and we'll dig into this more later, about some of those techniques to kind of put that in the drawer and put on your hat. What signs do you think, Mark, that you've seen that, in addition to kind of stress and fatigue and grouchiness that we all get, should clinicians be on the lookout for?
One of the answers I got back when I sent out the survey that I thought was real interesting for that was not having those personal boundaries, allowing a session to go over for 15 minutes or cutting a session short by 15 minutes. Either way you look at it, it's just a real sign of that. That actually came from our HR director. She said that if the supervisors are saying they're not doing or they are doing too much, it was a pretty good sign of it.
Mary, did you want to weigh in?
In terms of danger sides, I think it's therapists want to. I'm looking around at the audience, and I know sometimes people will be in crisis, and we feel like we need to give them the extra time. And as a supervisor, I think the danger side is when that happens all the time. I think there's always going to be an exception to that rule. Sometimes you're going to have someone who you need to do that more with, but to do that routinely, to always run over, those are the kind of danger signs that people can get into to where they can't really help anyone else if they're feeling overwhelmed themselves. And we all come into this profession generally because we want to be helpful, but we tend to not take care of ourselves because we think we have it all together, and we're probably the world's worst about self-care as clinicians. I don't know about you all. I know I tend to be. We think we can push through it, that we can make it happen. And I think recognizing that in each other and in ourselves before we get to that point, I think that's the real danger point, is people taking on way too much and not knowing that soon enough. And also just becoming more isolated. If people are isolated in their practice and they don't allow time to engage with other people, then I think you lose the ability to have that insight before it's too late.
Okay, so this question is not on the piece of paper, so yeah. And I told you I wasn't going to do this, so okay, I apologize.
Okay.
But just out of curiosity, how many of you are in private practice? Just a show of hands?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a fair amount of people. So you brought up a really great point, Mary. You know, with all of these private practice clinicians, you know, that is a somewhat isolating mm-hmm. environment. How can they kind of check themselves at the door, do you think?
I think the friends of mine that I know that are in private practice, the ones that I see that have been the most successful at that over the lifelong, have formed informal peer supervision groups. They stay involved in societies that allow them to get professional education. They have colleagues that they know they can bounce things off of. So they don't really isolate. They put themselves in a position to where they have a collection of other professionals that they can get that kind of support from. They never operate in isolation, and those are the ones I know that have been the most successful and had the best long-term practice. And they're really good at taking care of themselves. I have one friend I know who schedules herself out in the middle of the day and goes and exercises. You know, they tend to make sure that they're not seeing people one after another, because in private practice, you know, you're your own boss and you have the desire to make an income, so you tend to push a little harder and a little further than you might even work if you were in an agency or even a tougher boss on yourself sometimes. You have to learn how to self-regulate.
I see some sheepish grins in the audience, so this is resonating. Mark, you mentioned boundaries. What ethical dilemmas in the patient-client relationship, the patient-clinician relationship, rather, contribute to some staff member stress?
One of our program directors, actually, and I had a real good conversation about this, just an example of an ethical dilemma.
I'm going to interrupt you one second. Can you hear Mark okay?
No.
Okay.
How about now? I talked with Becca Davis, one of our program directors, men's co-occurring program, about this question specifically, and she gave a great example of this. We had a client who, to make a long story short, we had to report to the state some abuse issues, and the therapist didn't want to do it because it would completely destroy that therapeutic relationship that the therapist had with it. Well, not completely, but his fear was it would completely destroy that therapeutic relationship. So that was a really good example, I thought, of an ethical dilemma. It's ethically, it's the right thing to do. It's the law. We have to do it. But then he was faced with, if I do this, then the month work that I've done with this client, he's not going to trust me anymore. And so he really faced that. Another thing that came up in that discussion was also just basic HIPAA laws. I mean, everybody has faced that situation that I really need to talk to this client's mother or father or partner or previous psychiatrist, and I can't because they won't sign that release. You know, those are just some real good examples, I think, of just ethical situations that people are faced and can cause a problem. Yeah.
Chris?
I think as we're talking about self-care, one of the bigger ethical dilemmas is being able to tell when we ourselves are stressed. Research shows that a lot of clinicians may themselves feel that they're so distracted, fatigued, and overwhelmed, but yet they don't back off, they don't set limits, they continue, recognizing that, you know, by ethical standards, that's not the appropriate stance. And research also shows that if you're working in a group practice where you have colleagues, we may also see that the colleague is feeling stressed and overwhelmed. And although the ethical standards say that we should intervene in some way, perhaps talk to the colleague, ask if you can help, that instead, and maybe it's the kind of the group mentality, we may just sit back and watch for a while, as opposed to coming to them and saying, you know, you appear stressed, can I help you? That, you know, the dilemma is we don't intervene. We don't try to offer the help.
That's a great segue for our next question. I'm going to address this to you, Lisa. How and when should organizations that employ or that employ clinicians, how should they initiate these discussions with their clinical staff about self-care?
Actually, with my team, I initiate the conversation on day one. And most everyone that walks in the building, unless I happen to be out of town, regardless of which department they work in, they have to come through an orientation in my department, and I discuss roles and responsibilities with them. Even though you would say, why would that be related to business development? Because I found one of the issues is that everybody in the whole facility is there because they want to help. And so many times non-clinicians think that they are helping by what they coined at one point therapeutic listening. And I would hear the counselors all the time saying, I wish they would stop. So I just said, well, I can help you guys by having that conversation on day one, that unless your title says counselor or therapist, you're not a counselor or therapist. And just reinforcing that, but then explaining the value of their role and how self-care is important. And that is one of our core values, that you are not going to be valuable to yourself, your company, your family, if you have depleted your own energy. So focus on your role and focus on taking care of yourself, and you'll do a good job.
And Mary, have you found something similar?
I think being able to help people at an agency to be able to have core values and beliefs and have that stated, I've noticed over the course of time, instead of everybody coming into an agency with this, these are kind of my core beliefs and understandings, and not everyone's are the same, and there's a lot of confusion about that. Most companies and agencies and residential facilities and even private practices, it seems, are kind of deciding, okay, this is our core belief, our core values, and, you know, we have our ethics that we have to follow, but then this is kind of what we treat, what we do, and kind of defining that on the front end for everyone to get on the same page with that, I think is really important, because it encourages people to have conversations about where their personal health beliefs might kind of bump up against that and not be exactly that. Because I think that's where people get into the minor kind of ethical dilemmas. It's along where their personal values and their core values and then their ethical boundaries and then the company they work for intertwine. And then they might get secretive because they think they might get in trouble. So creating an open environment where those kinds of things can be discussed, I think, on the front end is completely important. And I think people come into an agency and they've been trained on their ethics, whatever they might be. But I think it's important to get trained again on what ethics are within a company, because ethics is more than just your social work ethics or your counseling ethics or your psychology ethics. It's also the moral stuff that we all take in personally. And then there's the legal issues that you have to face, that you have to bounce up against that, like HIPAA laws and duty report and those kinds of things. You have to kind of balance all of that in the end to do the right thing for the people that we work with.
So, Chris, in addition to kind of starting off with an attitude of self-care for new employees and clinicians, what are some examples of activities or policies that organizations can initiate to ensure quality self-care?
Well, I think it's important, kind of going along with what Mary said, that the environment is one of self-care, and that can be presented even at the start of the outreach, of the HR person, and almost presenting it that self-care is a benefit of the company, that it's truly valued, and you set up your culture so that the employees feel safe in taking care of themselves. And you can do that by, you know, having creative posters or, you know, kind of insignia around the facility so that there's that daily visual reminder. You can do it different ways with employee challenges, maybe, for a good cause. You know, if there's somebody on your staff that is involved with a nonprofit, then maybe there can be a challenge between departments in some way to benefit that nonprofit, like Pennies for Patients, Casual Fridays that will go to a partner or a nonprofit. And it builds that cohesion, and it allows the employees to feel safe with one another. So, and I think it's not necessarily a mantra, but in staff meetings, the leaders should be kind of coaches and saying things repeatedly that allows for the self-care and allows for the employee to feel safe and secure in saying, hey, I need some help, or, you know, hey, what direction should I go in this situation?
Mark?
Well, I'm going to answer it more directly with the policies aspect.
Okay,
what
great.
Can companies mm-hmm. do? I think every facility, I would assume every facility mm-hmm. has a policy for vacation. You know, that's self-care. I'm going to New Orleans next week. That's pretty damn good self-care. You know, we need that. Our companies have to have those kind of policies in place to promote taking care of ourselves. Lunch breaks. Everybody has a policy toward lunch breaks. One of the clinicians that I talked with last week talked about that being a very, very important time to her, that she stops for lunch. She does not read her email. Well, I mean, what do we typically do when we're eating lunch? We're sitting at our computer eating our ham sandwich, looking at our email and catching up, right? That's what we usually do. And her practice is, I don't do that. I don't sit at my desk. I go into a different area. I sit and I take a lunch break, completely separate from work. And I just love that. But companies, we encourage, we have to give our employees lunch breaks. And it's just a way that policies can be set up for facilities to promote that. Even as, you know, private practitioners, take a lunch break, get away from work, walk out into the park. Yeah, and you're thinking, but if I do that, I'm not going to know. Well, get away from it. Take care of yourself.
How many of you routinely do not take a lunch break? All right, so most of you are doing a good job caring for yourselves.
Glad you're here for lunch today.
Yes, at least for lunch. So, how can, you know, I'm a big believer, you know, you get by with a little help from your friends. And in my case, I spend a lot of time with my colleagues, and they're my friends as well. How can fellow staff members prevent burnout among their colleagues or address it when that burnout is starting to arise, even if they're not in a management role? And I'm going to ask this question to you, Mary.
I'm thinking about that. I think you have to create an environment where people can know that it's okay to do that. And I think that does come from supervisors. I think having team meetings where you are accepting and able to give each other feedback when you see a colleague really struggling with a patient, helping them to figure out strategies to do that and maybe to back off a bit, even making sure that caseloads are distributed in a way that not everyone has caseloads that are bad, but helping each other with that. I think that comes from leadership. But I think as a colleague, if you're in an environment that does that, you can speak up when the person looks fried. I mean, and that comes from having trust of the people that you work with and recognize that on each other. And those are the things you can kind of do once people are down the slippery slope. But I think also helping people to exercise, like encouraging your coworkers to do that, encouraging people to take time off. Those are all things that people can do before people get to the point where they're totally overwhelmed. The other thing I was thinking as we were all talking, we talk a lot about wellness, and then you like look at what we choose to eat at work. You know, we'll talk to our patients about taking good care of themselves and doing whatever, and then we'll be eating donuts and cookies and, we all have done that. It's like my favorite thing to eat when I'm really stressed is chocolate. And I go to Sonic, which is horrible. Ice cream. I am an ice cream. You know, Chris knows this. We've worked together forever. But to, like, really encourage each other to do healthy behaviors, I think, on the front end and kind of challenge each other to keep doing that. Take that day off. I'll cover for you. To keep people from getting to the point where they have, where you have to do a bigger intervention, I think is really important.
And Lisa, what have you found?
Another thing that's really important is to recognize that most of us have been trained in self-care a lot. Mm-hmm. And most of the people that we work with have been trained in self-care probably a lot, depending on their role. And we have been successful to a degree at whatever point we are in life. But William Bridges put out a book called Transitions many years ago that talks about the transitions that happen in life. And sometimes you have your life all in balance. You have your practice all in balance if you have your own practice, or you're just humming right along at work if you work for a larger company. And then all of a sudden you start hearing something has changed in that person's life. And it might sound like it's minor, but one that I just came through, and many of you may have already gone through it or be getting ready to go through, is this new dilemma where here you are middle-aged and you are raising teenagers, trying to get them through that critical point, and parents are living older but now with health issues. And so you're struggling trying to add that to your plate, trying to perform at work, take care of your clients, all of that, and it all piles up very quickly. So if you hear that someone that you work with, they don't have to work for you, but if you work with them and you hear these different things start stacking up on them, help coach them through it. Even if you don't have experience, help them reach out to a book about transitions in life so they can kind of expect it, or other things to help them get through that, because it's really overwhelming. And it was difficult for me to get through that transition, and I lost my self-care, and it took me 2 or 3 years to pull it back in. So just help recognize the symptoms.
Mark, what would you like to add?
One of our therapists, when we were talking about this, I like the way that she put this. A way to encourage coworkers with their self-care is I refuse to compete with them on the basis of who works more hours and who works harder. I really liked that. That was a real insightful way to put it, is, you know how we do. Oh, God, I had to work until, you know, when we avoid thinking like that, when we avoid those conversations, we're actually avoiding talking about workaholism. We're talking, you know, more along the lines of self-care. And I liked how she put that, and I wanted to share that.
Chris?
And I think Mary mentioned peer consultation. There's also the informal kind of peer consultation. Having a buddy that you schedule regular times to go walk with, and you can process the things that are going on with you and kind of relieve some of the stress that way. Maybe you've just finished a grueling day and you'd rather go home and sit on the couch and turn on Netflix or whatever, but you've kind of committed to going for a walk around the lake with a buddy. Making sure you do that, because maybe you've had a great day and you don't know, but your buddy's had a really stinky day, and it just kind of gives that reciprocal response, and if you've helped them out.
That's a great idea.
So, Lisa mentioned stresses of parents and in transition and children in transition, and this is a very educated audience, and many of you have student loans and financial hardships and everything else that kind of comes with life, but they're all contributing factors to clinician stress. How can these and other kind of outside problems be addressed by organizations, treatment centers, or others? And Mark, I'll just shoot this over to you.
The ultimate responsibility for dealing with the hardship financially that a staff member may have would be on them. It might be because they bought an expensive car. It might not be for student loans, even though everybody probably has student loans. So ultimately that responsibility, it really goes back on them. But I think organizations, facilities could make sure and have equal pay for services. I think that one thing facilities tend to struggle with is we hire clinician A and we pay them X amount of money, and we hire clinician B and we pay them a different amount of money because we can get them to come to work for us for less money, and then they're in more hardship. But to equal the playing field across your company for y'all that are at facilities, I think would be real key to that, just to keep that equal among all of the different staff members like that.
Mary?
Yeah.
I know when I've worked at places that have a lot of folks with bachelor's degrees that are getting ready to pursue a next level of care, or education, level of care. What I've noticed that there's a lack of real understanding of what the career opportunities are for people at that level. And I think as supervisors coaching people through their career, I think that there's a real change in the industry. I've noticed that, to where not only are we providing support to someone in their job with us, but having conversations with them about their long-term career goals and helping them to be realistic and to understand all the options that they may have. I think when this first became really apparent to me is that I had a young lady that worked for me in rural West Tennessee who had a $60,000 undergraduate bachelor's degree and was getting ready to go to graduate school and get another $100,000 debt because she was, you know, they were going to lend her the money. And to be able to have a real honest conversation with her about maybe private schools aren't the option. I think a lot of people don't have realistic understandings of what this field will pay, and we can help mentor other people coming into the field as professionals. Agencies, I think, that have staff that are going to go further along can provide real support for them by helping them to become realistic. And I also think any of us that have the opportunity to educate the schools where people are coming from about what options and opportunities people have, I think that that's incredibly important. We kind of have a professional responsibility for that in all of the different programs that we work with.
That's a great point. Chris, did you have something to add?
I just wanted to support that because I know when I started into the helping field and originally got my bachelor's in psychology, you come out with this idea of you know, all that you're going to do, and you realize, well, there's really not that much you can do, you know, with a bachelor's, that, you know, if you want to continue to have the impact that you want to have, you have to continue. So I agree with, you know, the universities and schools being very upfront about what you can do when you're finished and help the person plan their career. And then we can do it, too, as Mary was saying, as supervisors.
So turning kind of away from the financial aspects, you know, just facilitating a healthy working environment in general, are the, as Chris put it, the helping field, or the addiction and mental health treatment fields, doing enough to make their facilities, organizations, a healthy place to work? Lisa, I'll start with you.
I don't know that you can ever do enough. Probably one of the biggest weaknesses we touched on just a few moments ago, and that is the personal accountability. That while we are all trained to be helpers and want to be helpers, and this is the field that we're in, part of helping is making sure that people understand that they are ultimately responsible for their own choices and their own self-care or lack thereof. So we can always improve on holding ourselves and one another accountable.
Mary, would you agree?
Yes. I think holding ourselves accountable and giving us opportunities to be able to do the things that are health or wellness in the field. I think at work, I was speaking with Mark, was talking about there is kind of always been a race to see who could be the busiest in our profession, and we need to really encourage each other to stop doing that. The other thing I think that if we could do through our health insurance benefits is they're all really pushing now. I know for mine, they really encourage us to do wellness coaching and lots of other things. But for the insurance benefits that we have, if we can keep our employee population well, encourage people to go to their annual health visits, make sure that they have the opportunity to leave and go to the dentist, the eye doctor, all the wellness things that people need to do for prevention. Make sure that people are well educated on what kind of EAP benefits that they have. Most everyone can access financial assistance from their EAP benefit, but not very many people know that. It's kind of not expensive EAP benefit. And just encourage people to use them and to take off the time during their work hours to do that in the long run, I think would be a great thing that we could do for our employees. I think you have to kind of self-monitor that if you're in private practice, to make sure that you have adequate insurance company and that you do your wellness. You know, you go to your annual physical exams, you get your blood work done, you stay at a healthy weight, you do all the things that we encourage our patients to do, but that we do that for ourselves. I think if we can do that, that would be wonderful.
Chris, what other actions do you think organizations can take to improve the work experience?
Well, I think, as we've talked before, about supporting them as they're going through, you know, their day, their week, their month. But in terms of that, we also need to challenge them to put the caveat out in front of them as to what they want to achieve. And we can challenge that in a very supportive manner so that we're not just kind of getting hung up on this is where we are, this is where we need to stay, but these are some ways that we can have personal growth, whether it's through work, maybe to get the next degree, maybe we can assist. If there's not money for salary increases, maybe there's tuition reimbursement. Maybe there's bonuses that we can give for different initiatives that the employee has taken. And that then, in terms, challenges them to rise above, take the next step, and, you know, make improvements.
And Lisa, what actions do you think organizations can take?
being committed to professional and personal development is very important. So helping people have a roadmap on how to get where they want to be as far as their career is very important. But also taking the time to talk with the people that you work with about what some of their personal goals are and helping them learn how to develop their own roadmap and learn how to keep themselves on track, I think that's very important.
And Mark, I deliberately left you for last this question.
Oh boy.
Only because you did talk to 100 of your colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested, you know, in addition to insurance benefits and education and, you know, performance, professional development, what other kind of actions did those folks tell you that they'd like to see their employers take?
Well, all of them, of course, said lower case loads. And we said thank you for your input. Have a good day. Most everybody talked about the need for community among the staff at a facility, a residential level. The need to be together, to share together, the struggles of dealing with client Joe are what is there. Needing to share those struggles is important, but more important to them was the need to have my coworkers there with me, people to laugh with, people to talk with, people to joke around with. They just expressed a real intense need to have community among themselves. I mean, that's one of the things we try to teach our clients is get involved in community, and then we isolate ourselves in our office. And one of the things that the therapists were saying with that was we need more community. Facilities doing, you know, residential facilities, getting their staff together for staff meetings that are not about policy or about procedure, but they're meeting together for just the community feel, for meals together, for going bowling together, for doing outings together. That's one of the things that they talked about.
So before we turn the questions over to the audience, I would just like to ask each of you, what is your top recommendation for self-care for therapists? We'll just go down the line, starting with you, Lisa.
Probably one that was briefly mentioned on the peer side is to make sure that there's support and some clinical supervision in your model. SAMHSA recommends that, particularly with facilities that have co-occurring disorders as part of their program that they offer. It's very important that there is someone for all counselors and therapists to be able to let their baggage go, somebody that knows how to process it and they can let it go, because you don't mean to, but you do end up picking up some of the weight of the world when you're doing this day in and day out. So peer support, but also a good clinical supervision.
And Mary?
As I think about it, I think what she's saying is definitely probably one of the most important things, but additionally, making sure that you're a lifelong learner, that you continue to stay abreast on the most current interventions that you can use with the patients that you serve, so you always feel confident that what you're doing is best and you don't have the underlying nagging of, ooh, I don't know enough. And taking the time out to do that, I think, is incredibly important for people.
Chris?
I think being part of a team, and as a supervisor, I think the responsibility comes on you to build your team and to help your team members learn how to be a team and facilitate that team mentality. Because if you think back to high school, your high school alma mater, college, whatever, you feel this inclusion, you feel this value, this intensity of wanting to be a part. And I think if we can create that in the teams that we lead, then we can then take that the step further into the, you know, the residents and the patients that we serve. So I think team building.
And Mark?
Just developing a routine and order of self-care, the encouragement that we can give to our employees, that we lead by example, that we do. The self-care in a facility's got to start with the CEO, the executive director, seeing that they have set hours that they, you know, and I get it. As administrators, I'm on call this week. So I got a phone call at 2:00 in the morning. That's not taking very good care of myself. And, you know, you got to do what you got to do sometime. But being able to turn off our phone, being able to turn off our email to get away, when we as mental health professionals demonstrate that to our coworkers, they may take those characteristics on. And hopefully our clients will too.
Thank you all. Now we have a few minutes for questions from the audience, and I will try to do my best Oprah impersonation and walk out into the audience.
I have a question. Recently, I saw on the NADAC newsletter, it talked about, you know, where people could submit, could create an app and submit it, and, you know, possibly win a prize for it. And I've talked to some people who are creating apps, recovery apps, you know, to be able to keep the client abreast of certain things like meetings and more about, you know, community, the community of recovery, and also in touch with the counselors. I've been wondering, how is that going to work as far as self-care goes? Because I've been used to, when I leave work, can you hear me? When I leave work, then I'm gone from work. You know, I don't use it. Well, I'm doing something different right now where I have to have more contact after work. But how is that going to work? Because I could see how that could interfere. I mean, I'm all for those apps because I've seen a prototype of it, a guy that's making one, and it's really awesome. But I was thinking, now, who's going to be the person that's going to be in contact with these people after hours? And I don't want it to be me.
I'll take a stab at answering that. I'm not sure I have the answer. I've worked in programs where we've had the apps, and it does create the dilemma of you get something from your patient at 2 o'clock in the morning, and do you respond to it or not? And I think setting boundaries on the front end for that, and if you're going to have some with an app, and it's going to have an opportunity to get a hold of a live person, that is built in on the front end to where you have that when we create these things. Because there are going to be 2 o'clock in the morning crises for people. They're going to get on their phone. They're going to type in the answers to a depression scale and come up with, oh, my gosh, I'm at risk. They need to know where they can go in the middle of the night. And if it's all of us 24 hours a day, then none of us are going to be able to be helpful to people. So that's got to get built into that technology. I do think that there's a huge risk in that. There's a lot of the suicide hotlines and those kinds of things are in a position to do that. We can network together to form ways for that to happen. But I think it opens up a whole new 24-hour channel for everyone. And then there's the whole issue around payment. You know, that's the other thing. If you've got people who can access you 24 hours a day on an app, they may or may not come see you. So as a field, we're going to really have to work through that. And I think that those kinds of technologies are going to change the way that payment structure works as well. It's going to be different. But it's the brave new world coming.
Well, you know, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. We are a 24/7 phone society. I've seen you. You're looking at your phones. And we all do it. So how has technology, you know, smartphones, computers, iPads, how has that impacted self-care?
I think it's in a lot of ways hindered self-care because we are always available, and the culture of Americans and, you know, others are, you're available, and you know, because it's right there in your hand. I know personally I do not always have mine where I'm looking at it. My daughters, who are 14 and 16, of course, I think they sit with theirs like this. So maybe sometime in the evening they'll text or call me, and it's 30, 40 minutes before I get back with them, and they're like, Mom. And it's like, I'm not sitting on it. But that's kind of the expectation now. And it adds to that kind of the need to feel always available.
And it really forces us, when you find yourself in one of those transitions of life where you're getting tugged on by everyone and some of it is just unavoidable, and then that phone is tugging on you at midnight, waking you up from texts from someone wanting you to address some issue, it makes you really take a long, hard look at yourself and say, I'm the only one that can do anything about my life and my situation, and you have to start setting boundaries for yourself. Otherwise, it will drive you crazy.
Trey, I'm going to let you yell.
Yeah. I'm not a clinician, but I can relate to the topic because I have a young child, and physical ear. So I'm just curious, do you find a more frequent lack of self-care with young clinicians that are trying to establish themselves because they have to out of necessity? It seems like there's a thin line between being very motivated and being not taking care of yourself. So I'm just curious about that.
This is me personally. I don't think so. In some ways, you'll hear a lot about the new generation. They're better at self-care than we are because they are native users of this stuff, and they know how to limit their lives 24 hours a day. They may text you at 2 o'clock in the morning, but then they may decide that they need to sleep till 10, and they will for self-care. So in some ways, younger clinicians are better at it than us old guys that don't know, you know, like I'm bad about this. I have to like put mine in the other room at night or I'll answer it. I think a lot of it depends on the individual and how they're trained. I also think there's an expectation is to do a lot of 24-hour stuff, and we're going to have to look at it as a culture. But I hope that the native users of the technology will be better at it than we are, people my age at least.
People that have succeeded, it seems like self-care, you have almost have to give up self-care.
Yeah.
I think mine is more of a comment than it is a question. That's okay. Okay. I find self-care easier now that I'm in private practice. I worked in community mental health for years. I worked in for-profit settings. And I found that the policies were always there and the kind of lip service was always there. But at the end of the road, at the end of the day, the people who did work through lunch and the people who didn't take care of themselves got rewarded. I mean, Lisa said she was promoted several times in that organization because she overcommitted. I find that in private practice, I am allowed to take a lunch. I let myself take a lunch. I let myself come to things like this. Whereas even though it was said that those things were encouraged, I could never come to something like this when I was in community mental health. I could never come to something like this in for-profit settings. And so I guess I do have a question in that, how do you, and I don't know if you guys know the answer to this, but how do you really work against that, you know, very unconscious bias on the part of supervisors and organizations that do reward people who don't set boundaries?
I think you have to identify what your rewards are. I mean, everybody likes to be recognized at work, and everybody likes, you know, the opportunities for advancement or, you know, special projects or special recognition. But I think we have to look at rewards for us personally that are outside of work. I'm a runner, and I do martial arts, and so at the start of the year, I will set annual goals of what I want to accomplish for running, and that keeps me I'm away from, as much as I love my girls, I'm away from my girls. I get that hour or whatever time to myself. I can process what happened for the day. So it's kind of learning to value the other goals or things that you want to strive for, that it's not all about work. It's not all about that recognition or, you know, the praise that you get there. Finding other things and being committed to them.
Go ahead.
You know, at a facility level, I totally agree with the lady back here that made the comment. At a facility level, we give our employees the award for going above and beyond. You know, isn't that what we do? It's like, who do we give it to this month? The person that worked 80 hours, right? We need to start changing that mentality. We need to start giving the awards to the people that are the consistent people that take care of themselves and do their job on a regular basis, and you don't even have to worry about them, not the people that work the 80 hours. That's got to change in our field. You know, the statement earlier, what can the field do to change? Well, we are the field, and when we start changing that kind of thinking, that's when things will change like that.
Yeah, and the one thing that I think also we need to do that along the lines of what Chris and Mark are saying as well is that we need to start measuring people's outcomes for what they produce beyond just widgets. I mean, I think in community mental health, it's really difficult because you're in a fee-for-service environment, and you have a budget to make, and you've got lots and lots of staff, and they've got to see lots of people, or you're not going to be able to make payroll and do the things you need to do. But I think as healthcare moves more towards outcome-based funding, and we start looking at people getting better and those kinds of things, I think that will help that. In private practice, you have the luxury of being able to set, to be the one in charge of your productivity expectations and the one in charge of your agency stuff, so you have more control. But I think to get where we would need to get at an agency level or at a for-profit or in any industry that's in healthcare, we've got to do outcomes-based payment.
And along that line, sometimes people think that the outcomes is how many crises that they were the one that they were able to manage it. They called me every weekend, all weekend, or and so I struggled with how do I get this message across to key people, some clinicians and some others. And finally, I said, I know that we're putting out fires a lot during this period on weekends, and then we're spending all week putting out the subsequent fires from the fires, but we need to look at this proactively as a leadership team, because even firemen do not put out fires every day, all day long. Firemen, if you stop and think about it, they spend most of their time taking care of themselves physically, mentally, emotionally, taking care of their equipment, their firehouse, and spreading good news about the work they do, and very rarely are they actually on a fire. So that's when it started clicking with the person that was guilty of always putting out fires, because that's what they felt their outcome and their that was their badge of honor. So it started clicking in their brain, oh, even firemen don't do it every day all day.
We have time for one more question. Or now we can have lunch. Can I have one more round of applause for our speakers and our sponsors, please? Thank you all for attending today. Please do fill out those evaluations so that we continue to offer continuing education credit, and we hope to see you the next time we're in Nashville. Thank you.
No, we bounced off, and yes, I did. And that wasn't even the Three Musketeers.